increasingly large sums to see medical specialists. Also, after 7:30, we'll discuss this issue of whether age verification systems could stop minors from gambling. We're going to talk to a gambling reform researcher.
ABC News. Good morning, I'm Simon Lauder. The Israeli military says it's prepared for a long campaign against the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
The Lebanese health ministry says 569 people have been killed by Israeli airstrikes since Monday morning. That includes 94 women and 50 children. Lebanon's health minister says a large number were civilians killed in their own homes. Israel says its strikes destroyed tens of thousands of Hezbollah rockets and missiles, many stored in civilian areas. Hezbollah fired around 300 rockets into Israel yesterday. The Lebanese government says tens of thousands of people have fled their homes.
US President Joe Biden has told the UN General Assembly the world is once again at an inflection point, but must not lose heart in tackling the challenges it faces. Here's North America correspondent Carrington Clark.
In the final months of his term in office, the US president urged those assembled and watching from afar to remember that holding on to their own positions should not be their major motivation.
Let us never forget, some things are more important than staying in power. It's your people.
He urged the world to keep supporting Ukraine in its battle against Russia and also implored Israel and Hamas to come to terms to end their nearly year-long conflict, which has cost tens of thousands of lives, the vast majority of them Palestinians.
Hundreds of people rallied in Sydney's CBD last night to protest the escalation in Israeli airstrikes in southern Lebanon. The snap protest was attended by people carrying Lebanese and Palestinian flags and took place outside Sydney's town hall. Jamal Kia from the Lebanese Muslim Association says further protests in Sydney are likely.
There will be rallies and it'll be calling on the Australian government to show some leadership and to show some courage in calling out atrocities where they happen to be, whoever is the perpetrator, be they friend or foe.
Medicare now covers just over half of specialist appointment fees, forcing Australians to increasingly dip into their own pockets, as experts declare the rebates are almost meaningless. Political reporter Stephanie Dalzell has more.
The figures from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare show Medicare funding for specialist fees dropped to an all-time low of 52% between January and March, down from 72% two decades ago. National Association of Specialist Obstetricians and Gynecologists President Gino Pecoraro says the Medicare rebate hasn't kept pace with inflation.
They're almost meaningless when it comes to accessing care.
Health Minister Mark Butler says all Australians deserve access to affordable healthcare, saying the federal government has delivered the largest investments in Medicare in decades.
Environment groups say the federal government is locking in decades of greenhouse gas emissions by approving extensions to three coal mines in New South Wales. The Federal Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek yesterday issued approvals to extend the life of MAC Energy's Mount Pleasant mine near Muswellbrook, the nearby Ashton Coal Operations Ravensworth mine and Whitehaven Coal's mine at Narrabri. It's understood the extensions will secure about 1,800 jobs, which has been welcomed by the Minerals Council of Australia. But Lock the Gate Alliance spokeswoman Carmel Flint says it's reckless.
At a time when there's been enormous pressure and focus on the government about needing to improve their environment laws so they consider climate change. And instead of doing that, they've gone in the opposite direction and rushed through a bunch of what are really massive thermal coal mine expansions.
Monthly inflation figures will be released this morning, giving the Reserve Bank more data on its thinking on future interest rate movement. Sam Wilkinson reports.
The Reserve Bank yesterday left interest rates on hold at 4.35%, saying that inflation was still too high for a cut. This morning, the latest monthly inflation figures come out. RBA Governor Michelle Bullock says they'll look at that data, as well as the quarterly inflation figures due out at the end of October.
The board needs to be confident that inflation is moving sustainably towards the target before any decisions are made about a reduction in interest rates.
Many economists are tipping today's monthly inflation to fall within the RBA's target band of 2-3%.
You're listening to the latest ABC News. For more news at any time, you can download the ABC Listen app. Returning overseas, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has used his address to the UN Security Council to accuse Russia of committing an international crime. Mr. Zelensky is in the US seeking support for what he calls a victory plan to end the war that started when Russia launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. He says Russia has caused immense damage to his country.
From the very first second of this war, Russia has been doing things that cannot possibly be justified under the UN Charter. Every destroyed Ukrainian city, every burned village serves as proof that Russia is committing an international crime.
CrowdStrike has apologised for an outage that crashed 8.5 million PCs around the world earlier this year. A US congressional subcommittee is investigating the incident, which impacted banks, airlines, shops, media companies and transport services. A senior vice president at CrowdStrike, Adam Myers, says the company was at fault for the crash.
On behalf of everyone at CrowdStrike, I want to apologise. We're deeply sorry. And we are determined to prevent this from ever happening again. I can assure you that we continue to approach this with a great sense of urgency. I want to underscore that this was not a cyber attack.
Back home, a teenager has been charged with murder over an alleged fatal stabbing in Melbourne's northwest, which left another teenager dead. Costa Haratos reports.
Police say a 15-year-old boy allegedly pulled a knife and stabbed a 16-year-old boy after a verbal altercation between the two turned violent. Police say the alleged stabbing took place in a busy food court at the Woodgrove Shopping Centre in Melton West around midday on Tuesday. A bystander attempted CPR on the victim, but he died at the scene. The 15-year-old boy allegedly fled the shopping centre before he was arrested yesterday afternoon. He's been charged with one count of murder and will appear at a children's court at a later date.
A fresh search for the body of missing Ballarat woman Samantha Murphy will continue 7 months on from her disappearance. Nate Woodall has the details.
Police have resumed the search for 51-year-old Samantha Murphy, who was last seen alive in February, before she disappeared while out on a morning run. Victoria Police say they have carried out regular, small-scale searches as part of their investigation, launching a fresh search in the bushland near Ballarat yesterday. 23-year-old Patrick Stevenson has been charged with murder over Ms. Murphy's disappearance and is set to face court in November. Police say Ms. Murphy's family has been advised of the search but has asked the public not to join in. The search will continue today.
12 Singaporean servicemen have been taken to hospital after two army tanks collided during a military training exercise near Rockhampton in central Queensland. Vanessa Jarrett reports.
A Hunter armoured fighting vehicle ran into the back of another tank while moving back to base at Shoalwater Bay training area last night around 7:40. 12 Singapore servicemen were taken to hospital. No Australian Defence Force personnel or vehicles were involved. The army has called for a safety pause to remind drivers to maintain proper distance. The incident occurred as part of the annual Exercise Wallaby, which runs in the region until November 3rd and involves more than 6,000 troops.
Now with sport, here's Daniela Intilli.
Australia have defeated New Zealand by 5 wickets in Brisbane to complete a 3-0 sweep of the T20 Women's Cricket Series. Ashley Gardner was named Player of the Series and says the team will go into next month's World Cup confident but not complacent.
We played really well across the three games, but also we have so many things to work on going into the World Cup.
Meanwhile, England's men's team have beaten Australia by 46 runs under the Duckworth-Lewis-Stern method in a rain-interrupted third cricket one-day international at Chesterley Street. Sydney Swans captain Callum Mills faces a fitness test today to determine his availability for Saturday's AFL Grand Final against the Brisbane Lions at the MCG. The 27-year-old injured his hamstring during the Swans qualifying final win over the Giants. Coach John Longmire also says Logan McDonald is expected to be available for the decider. Brisbane coach Chris Fagan has revealed that ruckman Darcy Ford is set to come in for the injured Oscar McInerney, who twice dislocated his shoulder. And Richmond have made it four straight AFLW wins with a 21-point victory over Port Adelaide at Prince's Park. The result lifts the Tigers to second on the ladder.
To finance, US stocks have edged further into record heights after a bumpy start to the day. At close, the S&P 500 is up 0.25%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 0.2%, and the NASDAQ is up 0.5%. The Australian dollar is higher, trading at 68.9 US cents, and gold is up to 2,687 US an ounce. ABC News.
Across Australia, you're listening to RN Breakfast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. The Lebanese Ministry of Health says more people, most of them civilians, have died in a second day of intense Israeli bombing around Lebanon. The death toll now stands at 569, with tens of thousands of Lebanese fleeing Israeli strikes in Lebanon's south and the Bekaa Valley. The Lebanese militant group Hezbollah fired 300 rockets into Israel yesterday, and the Israeli military is warning the fighting could go on for some time. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
On her 12-hour drive from Lebanon south to Beirut, Fatma says she saw scenes of horror. There were so many refugees, cars, people, children, and massacres we saw while on the roads, she says. There was bombing everywhere. They spared nobody. We felt like it was the apocalypse. Hassan fled the south to Beirut yesterday, arriving after a seven-hour journey with his family, including a three-month-old baby.
We felt that the situation is going to be a long situation. So now we are searching for an apartment to stay in. We found one. Now we're going to sit in it to see where things is going.
Hassan saw an Israeli missile land near his workplace and says Lebanon will not be able to handle such a large displacement of people for a long time.
It's hard to leave your work, your home, and sit here in a place that you don't belong. This situation cannot stay like this a lot, like Gaza. No, I don't think Lebanese people can overcome this situation.
Israeli airstrikes have killed hundreds of Lebanese over the past 2 days. Israel says it's targeting Hezbollah weapons stored in civilian homes, and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the group's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, is to blame for the destruction and displacement.
Nasrallah is leading you to the brink of the abyss. I told you yesterday to evacuate the houses in which a missile was planted in your living room and a rocket in your garage. Anyone who has a missile in their living room and a rocket in their garage will not have a home. But I will tell you another thing. He is endangering your country. Rid yourselves from the grip of Hezbollah.
But Lebanon's caretaker health minister, Firas Abiad, says many of the people killed were civilians.
This honestly contradicts all the lies that the Israeli enemy has said, that they target militants and other talk. In all honesty, and unfortunately, we are seeing that the majority of, if not all of the deaths from the attacks yesterday, are from residents who were in their homes.
Israel says it will keep fighting until Hezbollah withdraws from the border area and stops firing rockets, drones and missiles into Israel, something Hezbollah's been doing for nearly a year. The United Nations, European Union and many countries called on Israel and Hezbollah to stand down. Ravina Shamdasani, spokesperson for the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, says the situation in Lebanon echoes the one in Gaza.
Have we not learned anything from what has been happening in Gaza over the past year? We've heard all this before, haven't we, last year and throughout the past year. This is not normal and this needs to stop.
The Israeli military, however, says it's prepared for a potentially long campaign and Hezbollah has promised to fight on.
Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek there. The United States President Joe Biden has used what's likely to be his final appearance at the United Nations to call for peace. World leaders have assembled in New York for a high-level meeting at the UN's General Assembly. North America correspondent Carrington Clark is in New York. Carrington, President Biden says a diplomatic solution between Israel and Hezbollah is still possible. How?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a difficult question. There wasn't a lot of actual detail about what practical steps he believes the two sides can take, except that he says, just as was the case when he first took to office, say, 5 decades ago, the world is in this midst of conflict in multiple arenas. He says the world should not despair and there are solutions that are possible, particularly paying focus to the escalating conflict between Israel and its northern neighbour. So this was the United States president in his swan song address to the United Nations a little earlier.
Since October 7, we've also been determined to prevent a wider war that engulfs the entire region. Hezbollah, unprovoked, joined the October 7 attack, launching rockets into Israel. Almost a year later, too many on each side of the Israeli-Lebanon border remain displaced. Full-scale war is not in anyone's interest. Even if the situation has escalated, a diplomatic solution is still possible. In fact, it remains the only path to lasting security to allow the residents from both countries to return to their homes and the border safely. And that's what we're working tirelessly to achieve.
What are you expecting at the rest of the week at this UN high-level leaders meeting?
Yeah, I mean, this is often described as the Super Bowl of international diplomacy, but the United Nations often looks incapable of actually achieving its stated aims, which is world peace and trying to manage the disputes around the world, and often does look like a bit of a talk fest. The backdrop of this escalating conflict in the Middle East is hard to ignore, but we also have the ongoing war in Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky is here representing his country, Ukraine, and trying to implore the world to not forget their conflict with so much focus now on the Middle East. There will be these series of bilateral engagements. This is world leaders and foreign ministers meeting their counterparts in order to work through some of their issues. Today, we've got the Australian Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, meeting with her Chinese counterpart. But as far as real practical steps are concerned, it's hard to see how any solution to the conflicts around the world are going to be achieved. And all we really heard from the speech from Joe Biden is just how far apart all the different sides currently are, particularly in the Middle East and Ukraine. And it's hard to see what concrete results we will achieve.
That's our North America correspondent, Carrington Clark there. You're listening to AM and it's 16 past 7. For more news, you can download the ABC Listen app. Coming up on Radio National Breakfast, Steve Kinnane interviews the Federal Shadow Minister for Finance, Jane Hume. If you found yourself handing over more and more money each time you see a medical specialist, you're not alone. Official data shows Medicare is now covering just over half of specialist fees, with Australians paying billions in out-of-pocket costs. Experts argue it shows Medicare rebates have become almost meaningless. They're calling for greater choice and transparency of medical specialists and their fees. Political reporter Stephanie Dalzell has more.
Danielle Tooley was shocked when she had to fork out hundreds of dollars in private appointments and scans during her second pregnancy. She wasn't able to access a publicly funded midwifery program in her regional Victorian town of Wodonga.
There's probably a lot of women out there who just can't afford to pay that. So I guess they're putting themselves and their unborn babies at risk because of they just can't financially afford to have these appointments.
The cost of specialist appointments is rising, but the amount Medicare covers isn't keeping pace. Data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare shows Medicare covered just 52% of specialist provider fees from January to March, the lowest rate on record, down from 72% 2 decades ago. Expectant parents like Danielle are particularly hard hit. Medicare covered just 39% of obstetric fees in July.
It disadvantages women because we're the ones who have to pay for all these appointments.
Dr. Gino Pecoraro, president of the National Association of Specialist Obstetricians and Gynecologists, says Medicare rebates need to be increased.
Over time, the Medicare rebates fall further and further behind, so that we see now where they're almost meaningless when it comes to accessing care. It is so far out of touch.
Australians paid $2.3 billion in out-of-pocket costs for specialist consultations in the 2023 financial year. Grattan Institute's Health Program Director Peter Braden says those fees are a major barrier to equitable healthcare access in Australia.
Bulk billing of specialist care is falling fast and fees are rising fast. And nearly a million Australians say they are delaying or skipping specialist care altogether because of the cost.
To tackle the problem, he recommends boosting the supply of specialists, expanding public care for people who can't afford private fees, and increasing transparency around how much specialists charge.
The government could look at things like saying, well, we're actually going to take back the public funding we've given you through the Medicare rebate because you're charging fees that are unreasonable.
In a statement, Health Minister Mark Butler said all Australians deserved access to affordable healthcare and called on the private health sector, including specialists, to do more to protect patients from exorbitant bills. He said the Albanese government had delivered the largest investments in Medicare in decades.
Stephanie Dalzell with that report. Moves by the United States to effectively shut out Chinese car manufacturers over national security concerns are being closely watched in Australia. Chinese cars are a growing presence on Australian roads, offering some of the cheapest electric vehicles on the market. Security experts and the federal opposition are keen to see an Australian response, but industry figures are warning any move to restrict Chinese cars could be complicated. Political reporter Tom Lowry has more.
Chinese car maker BYD markets itself as offering customers the future of driving.
Hi BYD, turn the aircon off.
Got it. Turning off AC.
And its electric cars are popular. It sold nearly 2,000 cars in Australia in May as a lower-cost EV option. But in the United States, BYD and other Chinese car manufacturers are becoming a national security concern. On Monday, the Biden administration announced a plan to ban Chinese-developed software and hardware in cars driven in the US, arguing the cars might be tracked or even used to access the power grid.
It's everything from internet-connected sensors, it's turning on microphones in vehicles, turning on cameras as those vehicles drive.
Alistair McGibbon is from cybersecurity firm CyberCX.
But it could be further still, right? Imagine if it's a connected technology, if the software is updated out of China, could those cars all just be stopped? And we should remember China now makes up something like 60% of the global supply of EVs in the world.
The Australian government says it is closely monitoring what the US is doing and has been speaking with the US government about any implications for Australia. Shadow Home Affairs Minister James Patterson has called on Labor to explain why, if the US is acting on national security concerns, Australia isn't following. Alistair McGibbon says there is a clear cause for alarm.
China has shown its colours before. It's a mass surveillance state. We know it collects information on its own population and has shown an avaricious nature when it comes to information from outside China. Why wouldn't they be using this technology to spy?
But a ban might be simpler for the US, which has its own domestic car market, than Australia, where all cars are imports. And China is set to become a massive player in the Australian market. Matt Hobbs is from the Motor Trades Association of Australia.
I could easily see it being the number one source market. If you have a look 3 years ago, it was 3% of the source of vehicles. 3 years ago. By 2023, it was nearly 16% of all vehicles were coming from China. Number three source for the country.
He warns any ban on Chinese components in cars would be difficult to implement and full of unexpected consequences.
The complications of saying you can't have certain Chinese components associated with communications or autonomous driving are huge and widespread and not necessarily obvious. Just because the car is built in Germany or in the United States or Korea, it may have those components in it as well.
Industry is expecting a rush of Chinese manufacturers into the Australian market in coming years. Any moves to stem that flow could have consequences for consumers and for climate targets as the government tries to push Australian drivers into electric vehicles.
Tom Lowry reporting. For those brave enough to tackle it, hiking the Kokoda Track in Papua New Guinea is usually a once-in-a-lifetime experience. But treks due to start this week have been cancelled and the track is now closed as local villagers have set up a blockade on it over a dispute with the PNG government. Australian businesses say it could cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars if the situation's not resolved soon. Papua New Guinea correspondent Marion Farr with this report.
The hard work starts well before trekkers actually hit the track, with months of travel preparations and training.
The gear that you've got to buy, you've organising flights.
Mick O'Malley is the owner of Australian Kokoda Tours, a business that takes groups on the famous World War II 96-kilometre pilgrimage in Papua New Guinea.
It's immunisations, you've got to get your backpacks. So there's quite a lot involved in doing it. It's not basically like just, you know, jumping on a weekend holiday.
But last week, the Kokoda Track Authority suddenly announced the route would be closed until further notice after landowners set up a blockade, throwing hikers' plans into disarray.
Well, in the past, the landowners, they would let you through the blockade if you paid them a fee. This is not the case this time, which is the first time in 20 years that we haven't been able to do that.
People from Nauro Village are protesting an alleged $15 million in unpaid compensation from the PNG government, which was part of a deal struck in 2010 to prevent gold mining in the area. At the time, the Australian government raised concerns with PNG about potential impacts to the historic route. Mick O'Malley.
Most of the tour operators agree with the concerns that the landowners have. We just don't necessarily agree with the way they go about trying to solve them.
Mr O'Malley's company could lose up to $250,000 in sales as a result of the closures. But he's more concerned about the lost income for local porters and guides in PNG.
70 to 80 porters over the last week, which will miss out on a pretty substantial income, which looks after their families.
The director of Adventure Kokoda, Charlie Lin, has the same concern. He says his company has invested almost $40,000 in treks that won't go ahead this week.
We've prepaid for charter aircraft, accommodation, we've purchased the food, we've engaged the porters who now don't have a job.
The company also had to evacuate a group that was on the track when the blockade was set up. Dave Sherry was the trek leader.
We only got out because Adventure Kokoda chartered their own helicopter to get us out. If we were waiting for the officials or KDO or DFAT or anyone else, we'd still be there.
Kokoda Track Authority CEO Julius Wagarai says it's up to the PNG government to resolve the issue with PNG landowners.
It's really outside KDA's power to influence.
The PNG government hasn't responded to the ABC's request for comment. Companies are hoping to rebook their customers, but for now, the track remains closed.
Marion Farr reporting there. As farmers face increasingly unpredictable weather, the push to grow more food indoors, vertically, is gaining momentum. However, the industry is facing a significant hurdle. That kind of farming needs a lot of power. And as the industry can't control that, researchers and farmers are exploring for ways to make what power they have go further. Luke Radford reports.
John Leslie is a man who knows a lot about farming indoors. His Queensland-based company Vertical Farming Systems has been in the industry practically since its inception, about 15 years ago, and he's well aware of the challenges of growing food in a warehouse.
The Achilles heel of vertical farming is to make sunshine inside a building with electricity is very expensive. Also to make wind and to pump water to make your own rainfall.
Vertical farming involves growing food crops in climate-controlled buildings, everything from massive warehouses to shipping containers. One of the benefits is it's not at the mercy of the weather. But around the world, the cost of power is the biggest handbrake on the industry, and a lot of the time, it's just too expensive. John Leslie again.
Vertical farms use power 24 hours a day, and so then you're immediately talking about batteries. We've taken an approach of reducing our power use by limiting the climate control side of it. We found that lighting is 60% of the power use and climate control is around 40% of the power use.
Getting power prices down is a big challenge. Just ask the federal government. So researchers and the industry are on a quest to try and make the whole thing more energy efficient. Professor Paul Gaultier from the University of Queensland is among them. He's worked with an international team of researchers looking at ways to use the least light possible.
Most of the time in vertical farming, we use constant light, which means that the light will be turned on more often. And so by modulating the light, by turning it in on and off at different time of the day, we are able to decrease the cost of vertical farming in general.
Professor Gaultier says while this improvement will help, it's not a silver bullet.
Vertical farming is a big building we need to build. Like I would say, that's a new stone that we can put to the building, but it's just, you know, it's one part of it. It's not going to unleash it. It's just going to decrease the cost to make it a little bit more affordable.
In the meantime, vertical farmers around the world are doing whatever they can to get their power use down, one of whom is Karen Brock, who grows berry and apple seedlings in northern Tasmania.
We are running our 48 square metre room at a total of 4 kilowatts of energy, which we worked out if we'd have gone with traditional lighting would have taken 28 kilowatts of energy. So we've actually saved a heck of a lot on running with LED lights.
Miss Brock is planning to expand her business and already has approval to start building. She says it won't be easy, but the upside will be well worth it.
That report from Luke Radford. In finance, locally, economists will be keeping an eye on monthly inflation data out today, and the Australian dollar is higher at 68.8 US cents. That's AM. I'm Sabra Lane at 7:30, and good morning, Steve Kinnane.
Good morning, Sabra, and good morning, everyone. This is Radio National Breakfast. The top stories we're following this morning. The Reserve Bank says inflation remains above where it needs to be, and that's why it can't cut the cash rate. It's clear the government spending is preventing the economy from going into a recession, but perhaps government spending may be having an impact on inflation as well. We're going to speak to opposition finance spokesperson Jane Hume. Plus, a push to consider age verification to block under 18s from accessing sports betting and gambling content could be on the table. We're going to explore that next. First, though, Richard Crabtree is here with an update of the news headlines at 7:30. Morning, Richard.
Morning, Steve. Israeli officials say a senior Hezbollah commander has been killed during extensive bombing in Lebanon. Lebanon Health Ministry says more than 560 people, most of them civilians, died in bombings over the last 2 days. UN and Lebanese officials also say 27,000 displaced people have been settled in temporary shelters, with tens of thousands of citizens leaving southern Lebanon. The Labor government has granted extensions for 3 coal mines in the Hunter Valley to continue operating for the next 30 to 40 years, angering environmental groups. At least 2 of the mines will target thermal coal for export and burning in power stations. Many economists are predicting Australia's monthly inflation figures released today will fall in line with the Reserve Bank's target band of 2 to 3%. When announcing the decision to hold interest rates yesterday, Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock